Today on Vox Talks Economics, new historical evidence on whether well-fed kids are less likely to get sick. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. Vox Talks Economics is outdoors today. Oh, for the first time in a long time. I am not going to tell you where we are yet. I'm going to leave that to the author of the paper we're here to discuss. And that author is Eric Schneider from the London School of Economics and CEPR. Eric, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hello, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Now, Eric, describe where we are and historically what is significant about the buildings near here.
So we are sitting in Brunswick Square, which in the 18th century was a part of the grounds of the London Foundling Hospital. And for those people who are not so familiar with London, we're about halfway between London King's Cross and the river. So that's kind of where we are.
In the center of London, aren't we?
Of London in Bloomsbury, yeah.
Yeah, it's remarkably peaceful here. And the only thing you can really hear in the background is some children playing, which is ironic. Because tell me, what was the London Foundling Hospital for?
The Foundling Hospital was founded in 1739, and early in its days, it acted like other foundling hospitals in Europe. So the original idea was to take in abandoned children and care for them and hopefully help them survive. But that didn't go so well in the beginning. In the early days, the mortality rate of children in the Foundling Hospital was about 60%.
Gosh.
And so they realized after a few years of that open admissions that they should be a bit more selective and focus on fewer children. Once they started doing that, the mortality rates fell quite dramatically. But yeah, it was an institution to care for illegitimate children who had been abandoned by their mothers originally.
And just behind us is the museum for the Foundling Hospital, also the statue of Thomas Coram, who I believe set the hospital up. What was the life of a child like who came to the Foundling Hospital?
Maybe it's better to focus on the period where my research is based.
Yes.
Because the Foundling Hospital has over 200-year history, and so it does change over time. But in the period that I'm studying, which is the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, the Foundling children are children of unwed mothers whose fathers had abandoned them. And so for the first couple of months of their life, they actually lived with their mothers because the mothers couldn't apply to give up their children to the Foundling Hospital until after the child was born. So they had a period of time with their mothers, and then the Foundling Hospital did checks to ensure that the mother was respectable, wasn't a prostitute, this was her first illegitimate child, things
okay,
like that.
Right.
There's a lot of middle class kind of respectability that plays
Absolutely,
into this institution.
Yes.
And then after that kind of initial stage, the children, once they were admitted, were fostered in the countryside with mothers and families in Kent and in Essex and Surrey. And then about at the age of five, they came back to the main Foundling Hospital site where we're sitting. And they lived here between the ages of about 5 and 15 when they finished off.
What happened to them after that?
So the boys took apprenticeships, and so they went into trades. And many of the girls became domestic servants, which is ironic because many of the mothers of the children originally were domestic servants.
Of course,
so it's
yes.
kind of this cycle of domestic servants that kept going.
Now, and we're not just here to enjoy the sun, beautiful day though it is here. We are here to discuss your research because you've used the historical records of the hospital, haven't you, to investigate the link from malnutrition to disease among the children who live there. So tell me about these records, first of all. How detailed are they? What are they like? How did you get hold of them?
Yeah, I mean, they are fantastic. It's one of those things as a historian side of me, when you see these things, it's like, oh my God, you know, it's amazing. So the medical records cover about 1,000 children, and they have kind of recordings of their weights and heights at three different stages of their life, in infancy, in mid-childhood, and when they left the Foundling Hospital at age 15 or 16, and lots of other information about the children's mothers and their family life before they entered the hospital. So that gives me the kind of nutrition side. And then for the sickness side of things, they actually kept a weekly infirmary book that listed the children that were currently being treated for diseases in the infirmary. So it listed the child's name, the disease they were being treated for, and the day that they entered the infirmary, and also the day when they left. And also it was updated. So if a child came in suffering from measles, but then later developed pneumonia, you could see that in the record. So you can actually look at the duration of sickness and also the complications that arose in that kind of final life stage when the children are living in London in the main site.
Now, the interesting thing about this research, you're trying to establish whether Poor nutrition makes it more likely that these kids are going to catch a disease, also, unfortunately, to die from it in some cases. Now, I have to admit, Eric, I thought that everyone just assumed this was true.
Yeah, it seems intuitive, right? It really does. But it actually depends on the disease. And I think that makes sense if we think about it, because diseases are caused by different pathogens that have different pathways into our cells and different ways of interacting with our bodies. And so, you know, some diseases are known to be quite nutrition sensitive, things like, you know, for instance, measles, although there's actually some debate about measles as well, and also respiratory diseases. And then other diseases, it doesn't matter if you're malnourished or not when you get them. And that would be things like plague or smallpox or malaria. Yeah. So it really depends on the disease. And so we have to be a bit careful about how we make those assumptions.
Also, when you get into it as well, I guess it's not statistically straightforward to observe a link from nutrition to disease. What are the problems you run into?
Yeah, so there are kind of two problems. The first one may be not so difficult, but certainly in history it is. And the first is that you need really detailed data, right? Mm. You need population level and like a population level understanding of nutrition that predates the disease, right? And that's actually very difficult to come by without a kind of cohort study framework. But most importantly, it's just the confounding bias. And that's because malnourished children are disadvantaged in so many other ways that it's really difficult to disentangle malnourishment yes. from all those other sources of disadvantage. So if we're thinking about children in 19th century London, malnourished children are more likely to live in crowded households. They're more likely to have larger families, to live in polluted areas where a lot of these diseases have respiratory complications. So living in a really highly polluted East London is going to hurt you there. And they're also more likely to have bad hygiene and nursing care in their household because their parents are probably less educated and poor and don't have the resources to help them. So it really makes it difficult to disentangle that relationship.
So in this case, looking back at the end of the 19th century, which diseases could you investigate? And how can you use the detail in these records to establish some kind of causal link there?
There are over 200 disease categories in the Foundling Hospital records. So there's a lot of rich data to mine there. But I've started by looking at five really highly infectious diseases that were quite common in the Foundling Hospital at the time. And those are measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, and whooping cough. I think those will be familiar to people.
I've had a couple of them.
Yeah. And, you know, at least you'll have been vaccinated against them, even if you haven't experienced them firsthand. And then in order to kind of get a causal link from this data, I've used the fact that the children move between different locations as a way of getting around these confounding biases. So for instance, if we just think about the time that the children spend with their mothers, mm-hmm. if I were to look at the effect of nutritional status on disease outcomes in that same period, all those confounders would be a problem, right? You know, those mothers that had better hygiene may have had less malnourished children and they would have better disease outcomes. And so I wouldn't be able to understand that. But what I can do is look at the nutrition of children at the end of that first period with their mothers when they're admitted to the Foundling Hospital and then use that nutritional status to understand children's exposure to disease and their disease outcomes in the subsequent life stage when they're living in the countryside with these families. And because they've moved, they're randomized across these families. So there's no evidence that the hospital was selecting children and kind of putting the best children with the worst families or something like that. So they're randomly assigned to these families. And then we're looking at the effect of the first stage confounders, which affect the nutritional status, which no longer actually have any influence on whether or not the child contracts a disease and their sickness from that disease. So, and then I can use that same kind of strategy moving from the countryside back into London.
So the question is, Eric, did poor nutrition make it more likely that our foundlings caught diseases?
So the answer is no. Actually, there's no evidence that the children who were malnourished were more likely to contract these diseases. I should say this only applies to these specific diseases, and
yes.
So I wouldn't want to go too broad on that. But one thing I think to note about these particular diseases is that they are highly infectious, right? They have basic reproduction numbers, those R numbers that we're all too familiar with these days, of 5 or even higher for measles. Actually, 3 of them are more infectious than the Delta variant, right, that we're dealing with now.
Yes.
So basically, everybody was getting these diseases, and there was no kind of lockdown or social distancing to try to prevent these diseases from spreading through the population. So it just doesn't really seem likely that malnutrition mattered for who contracted the disease.
But it might still matter if it meant that they were slower to get better from the diseases, or they were more likely to die from the diseases in extreme cases. Do we have any evidence on that?
Yeah, so that's where I got some cool evidence. So it's not just an old result paper. So for measles, there's definitely evidence that children who are malnourished had longer sickness durations. Mm-hmm. And the same for mumps, actually, which is interesting because mumps isn't really a deadly disease,
no.
even in history. It's very unpleasant, but not deadly. But it's interesting to find the kind of first link that nutrition has with mumps. It's a new finding from this research. And then also for measles, I find that, you know, it's not statistically significant, but very suggestive evidence that it also increases the risk of death. And the reason it's not statistically significant is, you know, I only have 1,000 children. There aren't that many measles deaths.
Yeah.
But the gap between the nutritional status of children who died of measles and who didn't die of measles is quite substantial. I would imagine with a larger sample size, you would have a statistically significant result there.
One of the really interesting things about this part of London is there are still lots of institutions here dedicated to the welfare of children. There's children's playgrounds over there. But today, it's a very different environment. There isn't a foundling hospital anymore. Mm. We have antibiotics. We've got a better understanding of disease. Far fewer children get diseases, and far fewer children luckily die from those diseases as well. So does your research and the research you're going to carry on doing about this, does it tell us anything about how we can protect children in 2021?
It's not entirely straightforward, the comparisons, but we still have malnutrition in the UK today. It just looks a bit different. It's mm-hmm. not undernutrition, it's overnutrition, it's obesity. But poor nutrition leads to large health disparities around the UK today. So the role of nutrition, I think, is still important. And then the other thing I think that this really highlights, both in the UK and in low and middle income countries, is that vaccination is really important, right? Children don't die of measles. They die from complications from measles, which are typically pneumonia. And the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which can be pneumonia, are also potentially a problem. So I'm not saying that I think that we would go back to the kind of levels of mortality that we have seen in the 19th century because nursing care is so much better. But there are some lessons about, especially I think in low and middle income countries, about food insecurity and making sure that vaccination campaigns can continue. Because if you have food insecurity that's related to civil unrest or war or something like that, which also stops vaccination campaigns, you could easily get measles epidemics that would be exacerbated by malnutrition.
So from now on, Eric, are you going to carry on investigating more diseases in this record?
Yeah. I want to next look at respiratory diseases because I think that's another interesting path forward. It also is linked quite nicely with pollution. And so I want to try to look at that in London as well, which London was extremely polluted in this period. So there could be some interesting kind of links there for current developments as well today.
It doesn't seem like it on a day like today, but London's still not that good.
Yeah,
is it?
No, it's true.
Yeah. Eric, that's really interesting. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Tim.
The paper is DP16361, The Effect of Nutritional Status on Historical Infectious Disease Morbidity, Evidence from the London Foundling Hospital, 1892-1919. Author, of course, Eric Schneider. You've just heard from him. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week, we bring you the most important latest research. If you want to know what you'll be reading in journals 18 months from now, I'll listen to Vox Talks Economics today. And there's 12 years of Vox Talks Economics at voxeu.org/vox-talks.